The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Thursday, April 16th, 2020. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Almost 3 weeks ago on Face the Nation, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was asked by host Margaret Brennan about some of the assistance people can expect from the federal government.
There'll be enhanced unemployment insurance. And three, as you said, there'll be these checks in the mail or direct deposit. It's really bridge liquidity for people as they go through these difficult times.
Bridge liquidity for about 8 weeks?
Well, I think the entire package provides economic relief overall for about 10 weeks.
Today, Steve Mnuchin was trending on Twitter. Why? Well, what prompted it was that clip tweeted out by someone named Brianna Westbrook, whose Twitter bio says, at Bernie Sanders national surrogate, vice chair at Democratic Party Arizona, organizing with DSA, that's the Democratic Socialists of Phoenix. Westbrook tagged the clip with the words, Steve Mnuchin thinks Americans can live on $1,200 for 10 weeks. But that is not what Steve Mnuchin said. That is not what this funding does. So for adults making less than $75,000, they get $1,200 plus a $500 benefit per child. That's for people still working, for people who are still employed. In fact, for people who may be making more than they did last year. It's stimulus money given to everyone who is in the middle class or lower to add on to your regular income. Now, the government also provides an uninsurance benefit of $600 per person per week. And that is also for 10 to 12 weeks. It is in addition to whatever state benefits they may be getting. So no one anywhere is expected to live on $120 a week or $1,200 for 10 weeks. It is dishonest. It is inaccurate to describe that as what Mnuchin is saying. And it's also wrong for the public to spread the word that that is all the benefits amount to. Look, I know people hate Steve Mnuchin because of his policies and his own wealth and his wife and his face, all the reasons people have to hate Steve Mnuchin. But Steve Mnuchin never said he expects people to live on $1,200 for 10 weeks. Not only didn't he say it, he clearly doesn't expect it, which is why he negotiated a package that gives you $600 a week if you're unemployed and $1,200 for everyone, even if they are employed, as long as they're not making over a certain threshold. Do want to say that people who didn't file taxes or don't report income or, of course, are here illegally and can't do that, they won't be getting federal money. That is true. So what happened was I tweeted, I don't know why I did this, but I tweeted to some of the prominent people who were perpetuating this incorrect assessment, incorrect description, lie about what Steve Mnuchin was saying. Katie Hill, the former member of Congress, did not answer. An activist and Bernie Sanders delegate named Rafael Shimonov did respond, and he tried to argue that his calculations were correct. Then he changed the subject to the fact that a lot of people, like gig workers, won't be covered by the stimulus. Okay, fine, but what you actually said was, and I'll quote Rafael Shimonov's tweet, adjusted annually, this means Mnuchin believes Americans can survive on $6,240 annual salary or $3.12 an hour. No, he doesn't believe that. He never said that. And when I pressed Rafael Shimonov, Bernie Sanders delegate, he dropped the subject. Within hours, Marianne Williamson retweeted the Westbrook tweet stating Mnuchin thinks people could live on $1,200 a week, and she called him the modern Marie Antoinette. Rashid Tlaib retweeted it approvingly and called for minting a $2 trillion coin, and AOC retweeted it gleefully dunking on Mnuchin with an Arrested Development quote. And that's it. That's it. That's where we stand. What does accuracy matter? You want to say Trump is horribly inaccurate almost all the time? Yes, he is. And he never stops. Want to say the intent of worrying about workers getting money in a tough time is a laudable worry, a laudable goal? Indeed, it is. But sorry, this is propaganda. And Twitter makes it unstoppable. And it also seems to me that self-identified DSA adherents, people with red roses in their Twitter feeds, and elected officials who adhere to that philosophy are far less restrained from spreading lies if it helps their agenda. That is a factor that bothers me. Given our media environment with its susceptibility to misinformation, it must be very tempting to want to exploit those flaws. Maybe you tell yourself you're only fighting fire with fire, but it still bothers me. It continues to bother me. I'd rather be guided by the principle of always trying to tell the truth to hem in liars than to try to become a liar for what I tell myself is a worthy cause. On the show today, though the Supreme Court might be phoning it in, they're never really phoning it in, and neither have the forces that have shaped the court. Adam Cohen's new book is Supreme Inequality, The Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. Yeah, you heard him. A more unjust, a less just America. From the justices. Cohen makes some interesting points. Don't believe me? You can hear him right now. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
When we think of the Supreme Court, we usually think directly of amendments and rulings that they make that are applied or applicable to the amendments, abortion and the right to bear arms and free speech. But of course, Supreme Court rulings affect every aspect of our society. And this is pointed out in a new book by Adam Cohen, Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America, i.e. it didn't just happen by accident. Hello, Adam. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, great to be here.
So the interesting things about the book, there are many chapters. There are two twin premises. One was eye-opening, and I totally buy. And one I kind of disagree with a little bit, but we'll get to all of that. But when you write battle for a more unjust society, assess the intentionality of the Supreme Court making our society a little less equal.
Okay, it is a battle, and it's not entirely their battle. One of the points of the book, and the reason I use that 50-year time frame, is something very specific happened in 1969. Richard Nixon is elected. There is, at the time, the liberal Warren Court has been in place for about 15 years and issuing rulings like Brown v. Board of Education, Miranda, which said you have to be told that you have the right to remain silent, Gideon v. Wainwright, which guaranteed poor people the right to a lawyer. So that's the Warren Court going along on this very liberal path in the law. Nixon is elected. He says he's going to change the court. And boy, does he. In 1969, he replaces Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, with Warren Burger, an avowed conservative who, like him, wants to undo the Warren Court. And then in 3 years, he gets a total of 4 appointments, creates a totally different court. That was intentional. And all the way through the last 50 years, there's been a lot of intentionality on the part of conservatives in keeping that conservative majority.
Right. And if we think we're living in a justice where the chief executive maybe oversteps his bounds and tries to influence the court, I think of the example that you talk about, which is Abe Fortas. I didn't realize just how nakedly political his experience was.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of us are very familiar with the Merrick Garland situation and how because Mitch McConnell wouldn't allow a hearing on Merrick Garland and there was no vote on Merrick Garland, that the Democrats were prevented from creating a liberal majority, which Merrick Garland would have. But flashback about 50 years, and something very similar happened with Abe Fortas. Abe Fortas was a member of the court. When Earl Warren said he was going to step down, Lyndon Johnson decided he would nominate Abe Fortas to be the next Chief Justice. The Senate does not confer Abe Fortas for a variety of reasons, and the clock then runs out. So at that point, Johnson's not able to replace Earl Warren with anyone else, and that's how we ended up with Warren Burger. But then Fortas is still on the court. When Nixon comes into office, he's looking for a way to get as many nominations as possible. He's literally checking on the health of some of the older justices. And he looks at Abe Fortas and he thinks, boy, he was weakened by his denial of confirmation for Chief Justice. And there was a little scandal brewing, minor, that Abe Fortas was accepting payments as a consultant to a foundation run by a financier who got into legal trouble. Fortas didn't do anything legally wrong. He broke no laws. He broke no court rules. But Nixon saw that as a political opportunity and actually has his Justice Department investigate Fortas, investigate Fortas's wife over a different matter that she was not guilty of, and threaten both of them with jail unless Fortas steps down. Fortas does step down. Nixon replaces him with a conservative. And that's how the conservative court was initially built.
That's an amazing story. Two observations. One is, you say it's comparable, in a way it is, to Merrick Garland. But in another way, the Merrick Garland, the way that played out, was positively genteel compared to Nixon's thuggery. I mean, they really, Dean investigates him, says we could charge you with a crime. This is really putting more than a thumb on the scale to, you know, evoke a justice metaphor. But the other thing is, if, as you write in the book, John Mitchell, Attorney General, threatened Abe Fortas, and Fortas was scared. And then later, I think Mitchell said, or it was generally agreed, that these were kind of trumped up charges, no pun intended. But it does make me question Fortas's legal mind. If he thought, this is a Supreme Court justice, if he was duly threatened by the threat of legal action, what are we to make of his acumen?
Well, he actually was a great justice and the most liberal justice, and he was responsible for some great rulings, including a decision I really love, the Tinker decision, which upheld the right of high school students to wear black armbands during the Vietnam War. So I think he was actually a great legal thinker. He was right to be scared. Remember, the people who were going after him were really thugs. John Mitchell, the attorney general, ends up in prison for Watergate crimes, right? If he thought these people might put him in jail or put his wife in jail, I don't think he was entirely wrong. They were also using the press to sully his name all the time. At a certain point, Fortas just gave up, and I kind of see why he did.
Okay, so let's talk about a couple other things, and we'll get to campaign finance. That's the one where I kind of question some of your premises. Education. I don't think people realize that the unequal education system that we have is directly influenced by court cases, and it didn't have to be this way.
That's exactly right. In the early 1970s, there was a strong movement to say public schools within a state have to be equally funded from district to district. It makes perfect sense. The Equal Protection Clause says the government must treat all people equally, and that should include, if they're going to run public schools, they should run equal ones. So courts were beginning to rule this way at quite a rapid clip. State courts and federal courts. And a federal district court in Texas ruled that Texas had to equalize funding between rich and poor school districts. It goes up to the Supreme Court, and the betting was that the court would likely affirm it because that was the way all the law was headed.
Yeah.
Instead, 5-4, the court says states do not need to equalize funding. And interestingly, it was because Abe Fortas was removed from the court. If Fortas had not been driven off by Nixon, he would have provided the fifth vote to equalize funding in every state in the country.
Now, would that have changed everything? It seemed that it would, but when I look at state court, there are state court decisions that essentially have ruled funding mechanisms illegal, and not much changes.
Some changes, and there are some success stories. Kentucky is a particular success story. But in fact, that's sort of an example of why a federal ruling was so hard. If we'd had a federal ruling that every state had to do this, we would have transformed education nationally all at once. Instead, it's been this state-by-state battle with state courts, which in many ways don't have the same power as federal courts to enforce their rulings. And then we've had a lot of recalcitrance from legislatures. I think if we had all done this as a nation in the 70s, led by the Supreme Court, we would have got equal funding. And absolutely, there are studies showing that the level of funding has a big impact on whether a kid goes to college, goes to a good college, how much he earns when he graduates, whether he ends up in prison. This stuff does matter.
Yeah. And unless we would think, oh, that's so big, and all the Supreme Court does is issue somewhat symbolic rulings like we talked about Tinker. Okay, what was the big lift? Did it cost millions of dollars to institute? That other case you cited, Gideon v. Wainwright, I mean, there's probably been billions of dollars spent essentially enforcing that case.
That's a huge ruling, as you say, because every locality around the country needs to come up with lawyers for everyone accused of a crime.
They just define a reality, and that's the reality you operate under. And even if it costs money, this is because the Supreme Court did decree it.
Yep.
Okay, so another aspect, we're getting to finance, contract law. It seems like there's a lot more wiggle room. And if you know the history of the courts have always sided before the Warren Court, always sided with big business. But there's a lot more legitimate wiggle room, things that could have happened and didn't, or decisions that were plausible and within the scope of, you know, established legal thinking that the courts could have opted for that really may have changed the picture of, say, poverty in contracts.
Yes. So in the 60s, the Warren Court was actually on a real campaign to change the place of poor people in the law in our society. And they issued some major rulings. The first case I start the book with is a case in which a woman in Selma, Alabama, a widow with four kids, sues because her welfare and her kids' welfare has been taken away because there was, quote, a man in the house. She had a boyfriend who occasionally visited. And they said, that means you lose your welfare. Supreme Court rules 9-0. No, the man in the house rule is illegal. So the court was doing these sorts of things. But then when Nixon takes over the court, we begin to see a very sharp turn and the court rules against the poor again and again, something that continues to today.
So the idea is maybe the poor could have been considered a protected class like black people are, like gradually now gay or transgendered people are becoming in some locales. But it does seem to me this is a little different from protected classes based on race, gender, sexual identity. It does seem that this would be a bit of a bigger leap than talking about not firing someone because they're Hispanic.
I think that's right. There are many ways in which being poor is different from some of those other categories, including that it's not an inherent quality, right? The same person could be rich the next day if they win the lottery. So that's true. But it is also true that the court was inching towards the idea of making the poor a protected class. And I think it would have made a big difference because the main test the court uses for recognizing a protected class is whether someone is a discrete and insular minority, whether they're a minority that has its own sort of group quality, and also if they can't really effectively achieve their ends through the political class. Certainly true of the poor. If the poor had been made a protected class, there are a lot of rulings that might have come out the other way that I think should have come out the other
way. Yeah. By the way, that's something that actually should be debated and would be an interesting thing for someone to introduce, especially given our progressive moment. But it does seem to me that that would be an example of a court which had similarly taken affirmative steps to do something progressive, failing to do so. So failing to do something that's plausibly progressive is a little bit different than some of these other rulings where they just sided with the interests of business in a way that doesn't even seem to be that consistent with the Constitution.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, sometimes, you know, in the old days, people like to say, oh, the liberals are these judicial activists. And they want to read things into the Constitution to advance their goals. But now we see conservatives do it just as much. They just do it for different causes. So, yes, the Warren Court wanted to create new rights under the Constitution for the poor. But look at what the later conservative court has done. One example is there's a whole area of law around punitive damages, where there have been a lot of cases where juries have awarded, rightly, very large punitive damages against defendants like Exxon for the Exxon Valdez oil spill, State Farm for the case that the Supreme Court heard. What State Farm did was just outrageous to one of their policyholders. And there were pretty large jury awards, punitive damages, to send a message. And the court created out of whole cloth this idea that the ratio between actual damages and punitive damages should be 10 to 1 or less. They read that into the Due Process Clause. Tell me where in the Due Process Clause you see anything about a 10 to 1 ratio. So as I say, conservatives are just as willing to, quote, make up rights in the Constitution if it's for people they like or corporations they like.
Or what about this tendency in business today where to get hired by a business or to contract with them as a contractor, you have to sign away so many rights of arbitration. That seems to be, and the courts have upheld this time and time again, and it doesn't seem to be, it seems like you can make a very solid constitutional case that this is an abridgment of the individual's right.
Absolutely. And there are a number of cases where liberals on the court held just that, but the conservatives had the majority. And this is so important. I'm glad you mentioned it, because people don't realize the degree to which in the fine print of everything they are signing right now is language saying you don't have the right to go to court anymore. You have to go to arbitration. And by the way, you can't go to arbitration as part of a class. You have to go on your own. And the arbitrators that preside over these arbitrations are very much biased in favor of the corporations. It's expensive to go to arbitration. And literally, while I was writing the section of the book about arbitration, I got an email from my bank, Chase, saying any conflict you have with us going forward is going to go into arbitration and you don't have the right to go in as a class. Well, that is an enormous change. We used to believe that you had the right to go into court.
Yeah. That's why we created this thing called a class and a class action. Okay, so let's get to campaign finance. And so far, I think the things you laid out were eye-opening and really do go at the heart of equality. And you're right. There is, I mean, it's absolutely true that our tax code is a major determinant of inequality in the country. But to get to the tax code, you say it's been influenced by the politicians who are voting for the tax code. The politicians voting for the tax code have often been funded in rulings like Citizens United, the court has ruled that you can't put limits on funding. I just think that's a little bit of a daisy chain that even if you're mostly right every step, the totality of conclusion, I do not buy that we have the tax code we have because of funding of campaigns, full stop.
Well, let me push back a little bit. If you remember when President Trump came in, one of the first things he did was pass the Trump tax law, and it was being voted on at the end of 2017. There were polls taken at that time which showed what polls always show, which is that average voters want higher taxes on the wealthy. That they say that again and again and again. Now, at the same time, when that vote was occurring, the campaign contributors were more outspoken than ever, saying to Republicans, unless you pass this tax bill and cut my taxes, cut taxes for the wealthy, I will stop making contributions. And when I do a PowerPoint about this book, when I go on the road, I actually show an article from The Hill, the publication, in which Lindsey Graham says how many calls they're getting from big contributors saying they will stop making contributions. And Lindsey Graham says to his fellow Republicans in Congress, if we don't pass these big tax cuts for the rich, our contributions will dry up and a lot of incumbents will lose their seat. To me, that proves the point.
Well, I don't think it proves the point. I think it maybe indicates that there's something to the argument. Here are some counterarguments. One, the Democrats who all voted against it, and even, you know, the median Democrat who wants a more progressive tax system, often get enormous contributions. In fact, frequently get enormous contributions. Another factor, I was just thinking about this. Okay, we have the federal level. That's one question. What about the state levels? 50 laboratories of democracy. So I looked up the most progressive states in terms of the state tax code, and I looked up the worst election laws in terms of contributions. There are some states literally that you could game on, you could contribute anything. New York State is almost that way. There's no way to track who donates, and the limit on donating to governors, $44,000. California, the limit on donating for governors, $29,000. But those are the one in two most progressive tax codes in the country. There seems to be very little correlation between allowing money to slosh into politics and the actual vote on the tax code that those politicians enact.
It's a fair point, and it's definitely a complicated picture. I would like to see what it would look like if we actually had very strong campaign contribution limits, which the Supreme Court has struck down, and the arguments had to be made to Congress based entirely on the merits and on people saying, I'll withhold my vote, rather than the sort of, I'm going to withhold my contributions that we got in 2017. I wonder if the votes would not be different. I think that they would be.
Yeah, it's a fine supposition, but to constitutionally say that this is part of the battle for the more unjust America, I mean, not Citizens United, but I can't believe I'm telling the expert this. So this is for my audience. Like, as you know, Buckley v. Valeo, which was what opened the door to the Citizens United ruling. You're a longtime veteran of the ACLU. The ACLU was on the side of not having any limits on contributions. It's pretty unclear that the issue of limits on contributions is on the side of justice or liberalism.
Yes, you know, the ACLU has not had a great record on that, but there were a bunch of us at the ACLU who always disagree with that position.
Mm-hmm.
It
was probably enacted like way before you got there.
It was, but everything's subject to change, and we couldn't get any movement. But there was a case long ago in which the Supreme Court heard a challenge to a city law that put limits on sound trucks in neighborhoods. And the argument was free speech. I have the right to have a sound truck late at night and wake up my neighbors and all that. And of course, the court said, no, you have the right to speak. You can speak anywhere you want. You don't have the right to the amplification. I think that's the same approach the court should have taken to the money question. They should have said, you have the right to make any argument you want in a political election. It would be a violation of the First Amendment to stop you from saying anything. The right to amplify your speech through dollars and be on every single TV and every Facebook account in the country, that is not a First Amendment right. That's amplification.
Yeah. So that would have affected, a lot of people say, oh, Citizens United, Bloomberg. Citizens United didn't affect Bloomberg. This original ruling, Buckley v. Valeo did, because it was about contributing to your own campaign. But, you know, Bloomberg didn't win. It's just one factor. But also as a factor is Trump was outraised by Hillary and Mitt outraised Obama. And in each case, the policies for more progressive taxation were the ones who actually raised more money.
Right. And I think we're going to hear many people pointing for many years to the fact that Bloomberg spent so much money and didn't get very far as a reason why, hey, money in politics isn't that big a deal. But if you think about it, people will continue to raise huge amounts of money and spend it because they believe money makes a difference.
Yes. Though, to be intellectually consistent, you'd also have to say when Bloomberg gives tons of money to the causes that progressives like climate causes or Every Town for Gun Safety, that also maybe implicates the, you know, donation and Citizens United rulings.
Yes. I mean, if they're just talking about issues like we support gun control, fine. But if they're contributing to candidates.
Which is what they do, which is why he said to go against the NRA, we absolutely have to contribute directly.
Oh, yeah. It makes me very queasy. I don't like the idea that our politics is turning into how many billionaires can you get on each side of an issue? And that's what it's turning into. That's not democracy. We need to try to get to a place in which everyone has an equal say.
OK, so I recently read, and I'm sure you did too, the Wall Street Journal reported that within the ACLU, there's a discussion. And the discussion is about free speech. To what regard do they pursue First Amendment cases? This happened after Charlottesville. And the official policy of the ACLU is whenever there is a First Amendment free speech issue, without fear or favor, we will pursue that case. But there are people, a lot of people within the ACLU, who put in a memo. And part of the memo is we have to take, we only have so many resources, and we have to take into account the content of the speech. And if the speech is impactful to a marginalized community, that's the sort of case we shouldn't take if there are other cases to take. What do you think of this? And do you think that one day the ACLU will be saying, these are the sort of free speech cases we will fight for, and these are the sort of free speech cases we won't?
It does worry me. And I think that the ACLU, just like Chief Justice Roberts, has to worry about not being perceived as partisan. I think one of their great strengths has historically always been that they're on the side of civil liberties. They're not seen as just an adjunct of the Democratic Party. When I was there, lurking back in the recesses of the...
When was it? What was the time period?
I mean, I was there in the 80s and early 90s, but back in the recesses of everyone's memory was the Skokie case, right? Where the ACLU,
Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, stood up for the Nazis. And we thought that that was a proud moment for the ACLU, even though obviously none of us supported Nazis. I think it's important that the ACLU always be seen as standing up for the Bill of Rights and not for partisan views.
So is this a generational divide? This is how it's been reported.
From what I understand, there is some of that. And also, I just think we are in a much more partisan nation than we ever have been in every way. Congress is more partisan, right? There are no more virtually liberal Republicans. There are very few conservative Democrats. I think we're seeing partisanship everywhere, and I think the ACLU is seeing it as well.
It's true, but doesn't the ACLU, even the younger generation of which you and I are not a part, see that it is an advantage in the marketplace, an advantage for their brand, an advantage for their credibility to not be seen as partisan, to stand up for the Illinois Nazis or the Charlottesville Nazis?
I'm sure
that helps them with the other stuff.
I'm sure some of them do, and I would hate to paint an entire generation with a brush, but it does seem like maybe fewer of them do than previous generations.
Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. The author is Adam Cohen. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now the spiel. You probably got them. They were sent to you on your phone as an attempting bomb in these chaotic times. Or maybe they came from the same helpful people who are telling you to drink hot liquids or to watch out for 5G. Don't burn any of the towers, they might have said, but watch out for them. I'm just saying. These messages come in texts. They come in emails. They definitely come on social media. They are Corona pandemic song parodies. And they are uniformly terrible. There is the Adele one.
Hello, it's me. I'm in California dreaming about going out to eat. Just a burger with cheese. Or a shaken margarita, baby, back ribs from Chili's. Hello, can you hear me? I am shouting out to neighbors who I used to like to see when we were outside and free. Is there something else to watch besides the news and Finding Dory? The social distance between us, and I'm freaking out.
There's the theater girl singing Fiddler on the Roof.
Mask maker, mask maker, make me a mask. Any design, please sew it.
There's the Beach Boys one.
We're in quarantine.
And there's this fifth grade kid parodying Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
Well, it goes like this. The fourth, the fifth, the sixth attempt. It doesn't help. My baffled father screaming at my laptop.
Well, he's not really parodying Hallelujah, because the chorus of this parody song is also Hallelujah, Hallelujah. Am I going to rip apart a fifth grader's musical talent? I am not. Nice guitar playing. Am I going to rip apart his lyrical writing choices? I am. But mostly, I am complaining about everyone sending these around, pretending they're funny or enjoyable. So many of these parodies. I mean, you know what the real virus is? It is severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2. That is the real virus. It has killed more than 142,000 worldwide. But the songs are not good. And the shame of it is, the opportunities are out there. For instance, shorthand for the, you know, acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2, is Corona. We call it Corona. And there was this hit song in the 80s, My Sharona. That song had screamingly good guitar licks. You can't screw that up, only this guy did.
My anus never stops being itchy. Hands are dirty. I can't even touch my own face. Drive me crazy now.
Yeah, take a lesson from New York City. Even during a pandemic, you gotta pay attention to the meter. I don't care if the world is falling apart. Words that didn't rhyme pre-outbreak still do not rhyme.
We all should still keep our distance, though this mask will cover a cough for me. Well, it's not about me, but if you are asking, I'll try to stay tough. Mask
maker, those are terrible lyrics. Terrible lyrics and a time of coming together and doing the best we can. But just because something is familiar, please note, parodists, doesn't mean it's fantastic or even slightly above average or worthy of more than 12 seconds I played on my show to mock it. These songs are less merriment and more meh-ment. Now you might say, come on, Mike, these are tough times for a parodist. Well, actually, there should be ripe times for a parodist. A, we're all desperate for laughs, to find a way to feel good about our predicament. B, more than ever, we have a shared frame of reference. And C, everyone's on YouTube. It should not be that hard. I'll give you some free ideas. All right, remember this one? Bette Midler? Social distance. That's it, social, instead of from a distance. Take that, run with it. The actual lyrics are so bad, you can't do worse than them. From a distance, the world looks blue and green, and the snow-capped mountains white. From a distance, the ocean meets the stream, and the eagle takes to flight. Bette Midler had to be paid extra to sing this track, I would assume. That does not seem like it fits in with the Bette Midler worldview. And mask maker, okay, that's fine. You could have gone with, here's the theme from Flash Gordon. And then when they get to the good part, just say, mask! That's it! That's it! And then there's the part where they have the movie dialogue. You can play some surgeon general or state officials endorsing mask wearing. Or how about this, right? Imagine Anthony Fauci singing this next one. It wouldn't just be a good parody. It would actually embody the best practices of public communication. So at first, the official said, don't wear a mask. Then they changed their recommendations. That pivot didn't go down so easily. Don't you think it would have worked better as expressed with a Motown backing track? Oh, baby, give me one more chance to keep out contagion. Won't you please keep it out of my lungs? Oh, darling, I was blind to tell you no, baby, but now, since I see community spread, I want you masked. Yes, now, baby, I want you masked. Woohoo, ha! I want you masked. Get it? I want you masked. Yeah, you get it. There are so many ripe targets. N95 Luftballons. You down with PPE? Katy Perry's Fireworks, but as tribute to Deborah Birx. Yes, I know it's Birx, not Burke, and Firework, not Fireworks, but the original lyric rhymes firework to what you're worth, so what's worse? These are fine ideas, and I really urge no one to take me up on them. Or if someone does and they record it and then it hits your inbox, don't overhype it. Don't give it 5 stars. Say, this is fine if this is what you need. You know, I say leave the parody to Weird Al, because no one could have thought of Word Crimes or Amish Paradise or even Another One Rides a Bus. And even if we could think of that, we don't have the accordion chops to pull it off. I leave you with the one parody I think did work, an English family from Kent singing a Les Mis song. If that was a truly great song, but you got to keep the kids busy somehow, and it clearly killed a weekend. And also, please note that it has been at least 18 days since they recorded that version of One Day More, and it looks to be several days or weeks more of this quarantine and these parodies. And that's it for today's show. Margaret Kelly is the GIST associate producer. She enjoys the Billy Joel parody. Don't wait for answers. Don't take your chances. Don't mask this guy. Daniel Schrader, GIST producer. Can he hear the people sing? Yeah, every day at 7, and it still freaks him the hell out every single time. The GIST. If I wanted to criticize a fifth grader for his musical parody, I have my own. You know that song, I Fall Apart by Post Malone? You know how that rhymes with Instacart? It's being workshopped in my house. Oom-pura-da-pura-do-peru, and thanks for listening.